Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books. And at this seasonal time of the year, as the calendars all change over, it seems to be the appropriate time after the winter solstice and to talk to Adam Frank about his book About Time, the cosmology and culture at the twilight of the Big Bang. You're an astrophysicist and you've got a bit beyond sort of astrophysics, but astrophysics has gone a bit beyond itself lately with the 11 dimensions and big particles and extra neutrinos traveling faster than light. So perhaps you could explain how it is you came to start musing about time and writing about it.
Well, essentially, I've always been interested in the intersection between cosmology and culture. And for the last 2 years, I've been running a blog or co-running a blog on National Public Radio with exactly that title, 13.7 Cosmos and Culture. So, you know, while the results of science are always, you know, of great interest to me as a scientist, I'm particularly interested in the way those results get digested and metabolized by the culture. And so, you know, there's lots of books out there about crazy ideas, you know, in cosmology. And I wanted to go sort of beyond that and ask, what does it mean? Why is it relevant? So in some sense, this book could have been titled, Does Cosmology Matter? And I'm asking that both, you know, for the general public, but then also for myself, because I have the feeling that science and the fruits of science make an enormous difference to the shape of culture and literally our day-to-day life in more than just, you know, here's a new cell phone. And so that's what I was really trying to explore, the way these ideas and the changing ideas in cosmology can affect the shape of our daily life. And as I did the investigation, what I really came to see is that the time logic of each culture, the basic way we organize ourselves through the day in terms of time, that is what has been so closely tied to cosmological models.
And you make the valid point that actually dividing a day into 24 exact hours is pretty innovatory. In the old days, the only fixed time was when the sun was at its highest, and hoped you weren't in England where you could actually see the sun to work out when noon was. But then you worked on either side from that pretty much.
Right. There's sort of the raw material of time that we're given by nature. You know, the sun rises and the sun sets. The moon, you know, goes through its monthly round of phases. And the sun, if you're paying attention, and of course, you know, up until 150 years ago, everybody was sort of forced to pay attention. The sun makes its round of where it sets and where it rises each day across the entire year. You know, that's where the equinox and the solstice are about. So, you know, that sort of raw material is given to us. But then how the day is actually broken up, how one organizes the day, breaks it into various units, whether they're exact or quite fluid, is really the part of the cultural creation. And that very much depends on the social needs, the social consciousness, and the cosmological vision that one has. So we often have this idea that, oh, ancient peoples, you know, they all had sundials. But that's really not true. For most people, you know, in Rome or in Mesopotamia, they weren't working with sundials. They didn't need to have sundials. It basically, you know, if you ask somebody what time it was either before lunch or after lunch, or the end of the workday or the beginning of the workday. The idea of these exact metered units of time did not really occur at all for the vast majority of humanity until clocks were introduced in the 13th or the 14th century.
Yeah, and to some extent, how it came about, I remember there's an Arthur C. Clarke story, I think it's the 9 billion names of God, where Tibetan monks have bought themselves a computer to work out the 9 billion names of God. And he pointed out, yes, we have a generator to power the prayer wheels, of course. And a lot of this temporal chronological technology was about religious festivals, wasn't it? It was to make sure that Easter was tracked properly, the prayers were said at the right time, that in other cultures... victims, willing or otherwise, were sacrificed on the altar at the appropriate time to do the necessary.
It's really true that actually most of the history, for people who are really into the history of calendars, and that, you know, I talked about in the book, that wasn't my main thing, but if you look at the history of calendars, especially the early history, so much of it is about power and religion, you know, power, either political or economic, and then religion. And of course, those are all tied together anyway. So the earliest calendars were really there to mark the rulers, you know, the head of the states, the important dates in his or her life, and usually it was a he, and then also to delineate when the festival times occurred, which basically also meant when you could go to market, when you couldn't go to market. And so very much the whole idea of demarking time, of having particular times of year being special, was very much tied to the growing complexity of society. So, you know, while very early cultures, you know, very early agrarian cultures certainly were paying attention to when the solstice and when the equinoxes were occurring, the breaking up into these, you know, sort of much more varied festival dates really happened with the introduction of cities and the beginning of a much more of an urban empire, or the rule of urban empires. So even there, you see time being broken up into different forms based on the social, economic imagination of those eras. And each time you saw those changes develop, there was a change in cosmology. The cosmology of the farmer looks very different from the cosmology of the urban empires.
Well, the urban empires are sort of, they're semi-detached from the land to some extent as well, aren't they? I mean, exactly. Other people do the food growing for them. That was the whole purpose of it.
Right, and that's where you see a very important distinction, in, like, you know, because, of course, cosmologies in the pre-scientific era were all mythological, and you see this enormous transition between the mythologies of just people who were essentially, you know, living in small villages, agrarian villages, to the urban empire. In the urban empire, suddenly the gods and goddesses in the universe they inhabit becomes very sophisticated, becomes very there's a lot of division of labor among the gods. I mean, I love in the Sumerian myths, you'll see the high gods, you know, doing whatever they're doing, and then there's all these lower deities who are being pressed into service to, you know, build canals and such. So you really see the cosmology reflecting the social temporal organization of the culture. And that stayed with us. And once we developed science, once, you know, clocks developed and the scientific mindset, including its cosmology, developed, you see a back and forth continue between sort of the social organization of time and the cosmological organization of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming even more recently, of course, the technology of shipping and navigation, mentioned the famous search for longitude, which was based upon knowing the right time wherever you were. And that was sort of surprisingly difficult. You know, those of us who look at our Rolexes and know the time wherever we are in the world, the idea that an intricate piece of clockwork being battered around the oceans for 3 years would be accurate afterwards it's fairly novel.
You know, one of the things we really take for granted now is the development of now, the idea of simultaneity, that the same it's the same moment in London as it is in Boston, took an enormous amount of effort to develop, and it wasn't necessarily it developed in some sense unconsciously, right? I mean, it wasn't like sort of people set out to do that, but they had needs. And as you say, the need to develop an accurate measure of longitude, which demands knowing that it's 12 noon in your ship at sea and what time it is. This is the same moment as in London, and being able to know what the difference, how far away you were, was absolutely instrumental to the development of commerce. And then later on, once we get telegraphs, which could send accurate time information, you know, almost instantaneously across large distances, that was absolutely important for the development of empires, right? Everybody's trying to carve up Africa or South America, and you needed very accurate longitude to say whether that copper mine was on your side of the colony or on, you know, the next guy's side of the colony.
So Adam, you'd written your book before the revelation from Switzerland and Italy that you could shoot neutrinos through the earth faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Does this feed into your message of impermanence about the nature of time, or is it going to change anything about what you wrote?
Well, no, I don't think so. Not at this point. I mean, most importantly is that the new results are very much new results. And I think most physicists, if they had to put money on the table, would say that the result is going to go away, that neutrinos are extremely difficult to work with. It takes a light year of lead to stop a single neutrino. They don't interact with matter very well. So there's many ways in which this result might be incorrect. And given the longevity of Einstein's results, I don't think anybody really at this point is willing to invest a lot of their reputation in standing up and saying, my God, this changes everything. So I think at this point, it's best to sort of think that relativity probably is in pretty good shape. However, the theme of the book was changing ideas in cosmology. And there, I think we're seeing a number of really important new results appearing, which absolutely change our perspective on cosmology. For example, dark energy. I mean, the dark energy, we have pretty good evidence now that there is this repulsive force existing everywhere in space that's pushing the fabric of space-time apart. And that really does change fundamentally our assumptions about how the universe works.
Well, one of the points, of course, is we've always measured this by the speed of light in a vacuum. But according to latest cosmological results, there ain't no such thing as a vacuum. That what we think of as a vacuum is a constant seething mass of particles popping in and out of existence. So wouldn't light slow down there the same way it slows going down through air or water because the photons are sort of bouncing?
That's an interesting point. But no, unlike the organized matter of, say, a chunk of glass, the vacuum does not alter. I mean, there are always interactions between light or any particle and the vacuum at some level. But for light traveling through empty space, its interactions with the vacuum are so small that it does not change its speed of propagation. So that's a good point that the vacuum is in fact a seething mass of virtual particles, particles that pop into existence and then disappear again before they can be detected. But that does not have any change in the properties of light. However, it does. Originally the dark energy, people thought that you could explain the dark energy based on this vacuum energy, this seething froth of energy that is associated with empty space. But it turns out that if you used that energy to power the expansion of the universe would be expanding so fast that galaxies never could have formed, planets never could have formed. So somehow the vacuum energy has to cancel itself out so that it does not produce the expansion of or the acceleration of space-time that we've only recently discovered and for which the Nobel Prize was handed out. So the dark energy has to be something else other than the vacuum. It's got to be some other kind of force, some other kind of energy that we really at this point have no idea what it is. But we do have pretty solid or getting much more solid empirical evidence that it must exist.
I think one of the objections that was raised against initially, I believe it's now been rebutted and refuted, was that in fact it was a relativistic effect because of the distance, the time that light was taking to travel between the different GPSs that calculated the distance and the speed of the neutrinos.
Right. And there's been, I've been watching, back and forth among scientists. It's very interesting. When something like this happens, you'll get some theorists writing papers saying, hey, I always expected this to happen. Here's my theoretical result, which shows why neutrinos should be traveling faster than light. But most people really are sort of sitting back going, okay, go ahead, do the experiment. What we really need actually is a second experiment. And there are people actually at the University of Rochester who are involved in this, doing neutrino experiments on this side of the lake, so to speak. And if those experiments are able to detect a similar difference in the arrival, if they measure the neutrinos moving faster than light, then clearly something interesting is going to be happening. But right now it's only one experiment, very complicated experiment. And I think, as I say, I think most people are not willing to put any money on the table to say that it would be true.
Well, it just show up. And since we're sort of based in the Catskills, it probably comes as a surprise to most of us that the University of Rochester up in New York has an astrophysics department alone, let alone that it's doing cutting-edge work and, of course, has cutting-edge theorists like you in it.
Well, it's just astronomy, right? Everybody thinks, like, well, don't you need a big telescope to do astronomy? And the answer is yes, you do, but nobody puts telescopes anywhere other than the tops of mountains these days or in space. And so, you know, the group at the University of Rochester has been at the cutting edge, actually, of building infrared detectors for space telescopes for a while. So you don't really have to be someplace where a giant telescope lives anymore in order to do, you know, cutting edge astronomy research.
Yeah, I mean, originally when I was trying to get hold of you for the interview, I thought, he's an astronomer, must work nights. I don't really be available during the day. I think this is no longer the case.
Well, yeah, that's actually true, though. You know, people, I'm a theorist, right? So I sort of, you know, sit in a dark room all day and calculate things with a computer. The observers, they do still have to, you know, quite a bit travel to distant lands and stay up all night, you know, embedded to their observer modes where they're, which I think is very exciting. I wish I could do it. I'm just very bad with machinery. So that's why I have to be a theorist, not an observer.
In fact, I read a recent article, I think it was in the New Scientist, it was Joseph Banks, the great astronomer in Britain, who had actually designed a sort of, it was like a pair of padded pajamas that he could sit there late at night in the cold observing.
It was really, right. I mean, when Edwin Hubble was doing the observations that led to the first discovery of the expansion of the universe, he and Milton Hubbleson had to spend hours and hours in the cage, what was called the cage of the large telescope at the time. You know, just making sure that, you know, tweaking the dials on the telescope in order to keep it aligned on the galaxies they were collecting light from, because they would have to collect, you know, days or night, you know, many nights on a single galaxy. And it was freezing up there. It was so, I mean, nobody realized sort of how difficult those observations were to make. You were basically on a mountain in the open air, you know, spending hours in a cramped position, fine-tuning little knobs and dials to move this giant 100-ton machine and keep it aligned on one single point of light.
Now, of course, the time has changed. Your big problem is to make sure your computers don't overheat with all of this information you're putting in.
Right. I know. It's amazing how radically things have changed. Whereas it would take them, you know, hours and hours, you know, probably a few days to make a plot of the results that they got. Now I can make one of those in a tenth of a second. And so the whole nature of science has changed by the tools we have. And actually, that's one of the points I make in the book, is that these computer technologies have changed the way we are able to interrogate the world, ask questions of the world. And in doing so, it's changed the kinds of questions we ask. And that sort of opens up a whole entirely new horizons for the kinds of ways you might look at the universe. And it's not just happening in cosmology, it's obviously happening in culture. And one of the points I was trying to make in the book was there's a feedback between that. Just like you and I can do this interview via Skype over the internet, scientists can now work together over the internet in ways that weren't possible before. And it's both culture and scientific inquiry that are pushing on each other back and forth. So the kinds of questions scientists think to ask with these new technologies are completely different than they would have asked 50 years ago. And those questions are being shaped by also what's happening to them culturally.
It's not just, of course, you're talking about the culture. I saw recently a news report. It came out about the same time as the news about the neutrinos, which led me to some speculation, because a company has actually built a new cable following the Great Circle route from London to New York. And they are, because they can knock 50 milliseconds, I think it is, off the passage of data between the trading computers in New York and London, this enables them to charge hundreds of millions of dollars a year more to the hedge funds using this.
Right. There is a really good example of how the technology shifts our behavior with time, right? The whole idea of making these millisecond trades or microsecond trades, you know, just couldn't have existed 20 years ago. And now suddenly we have it. And so it introduces a whole new set of behaviors that then shift our sort of creative conception of who we are and what we are and what we do. And that actually flows into what cosmologists do. You know, it's no surprise that cosmologists are now thinking about the universe as a information processing system, right? I mean, you know, hundreds of years ago, people thought of clocks, the universe as being a clock, because clocks are new technology. Now we live in a world where these information technologies are radically altering everything from economics to sort of how I organize my day with my electronic calendar. And it's no surprise that scientists who are living in the world, in the same world, take those same metaphors and begin applying them to their understanding of the universe. And that's not a bad thing. Some people may say that, well, then it's all just crap, right? Because everybody's just using whatever metaphor they have at the moment. But I think what it really shows is the way in which science is not just about discovering a pre-existing truth. It's about a dialogue between us and the world. And as we change culturally, it opens up different avenues for different kinds of questions. So I think what's really going on in our scientific investigations is that we're involved in this dialogue with this thing called the universe, and we're like the blind philosophers, the three blind philosophers feeling around an elephant.
I know, you've got to get your, it's seven wise men of Hindustan to learning much inclined who came to see the elephant. See, that's elementary numbers, you're losing
track
of them.
I just have that first, yeah. And right, each different philosopher or wise man feels a different part of the elephant and says, oh, an elephant is like a snake if they're holding the tail, or an elephant is like a palm frond if they're holding the ear. And I think that's really a very good metaphor for what happens in science. As we move along in different as our culture changes, we get to see different aspects of the universe, and that calls to mind different creative responses in our description of it. And will we ever get the ultimate description? Personally, I don't think so, but what we're getting is different views, and that very act of understanding how we change in with history should enlighten us about this dialogue, understanding that there is no one super objective godlike view of the universe, but it will always be a give and take.
That's what comes through. You're towards the end, you could almost be accused of taking a sort of somewhat metaphysical view as opposed to the hard-nosed empiricist views that we usually associate with science.
I've evolved,
a bit worrying, doesn't it?
I've evolved. Well, I've evolved over time. I mean, like most people, most young scientists, I was interested in the absolute reality. I wanted to read God's mind, as they say. But, you know, as I've matured, I think, you know, in my progress through science, I've come to see that idea that there's only one objective reality and we have perfect access to it, I think is a bit of a myth that we need. And as we grow in our understanding of science, you know, I love science, it's what I do every day, I think we have to come to a more nuanced understanding about our interaction with the world. And there is a part, like one question I always ask myself is, what would have happened if science originated in the East rather than in the West, the methodologies of science? Because in the West, we are very much, we have the bias, so to speak, of the Greeks, of Plato and Pythagoras. And, you know, they're this whole idea of to know the true existence behind the illusion of reality, right? And which very much was later on became a Neoplatonic idea with a Christian aspect of like there's one true God and you want to know God's thoughts. But in the East, they never really had this kind of conception. They understood their conception was that, you know, that there is, you know, many facets, many aspects of reality. And there wasn't this importance or this bias towards knowing unity, the unity of reality behind the appearances. And so I just wonder whether or not, you know, this idea that we have to find the one force behind the four known existing forces, what baggage are we sort of carrying when we sort of force that idea onto the world?
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to Adam Frank about his book About Time. And it's timely, of course, as the year changes. But, you know, Adam, aren't you a bit in danger of getting into the Deepak Chopra syndrome of science is very complicated, theology is very complicated, therefore basically the same thing?
No, absolutely not. I don't think, you know, I mean, yeah, Deepak Chopra and I have many problems.
Good.
Should we ever get into a debate? I mean, the question here, it's not, you know, we have science. Science is this incredibly powerful tool. And what we have to try and do is remain grounded in what we do understand, right? And what we do have empirical evidence for. But at the same time, what we can't do is then take that empirical evidence and stretch it beyond what it can tell us. And when it comes to the universe, right, we can barely even define what the universe means, right? I mean, there's the observable universe, everything we can see, and then there is, you know, what lies beyond it. And is the universe all possible universes? Does a true multiverse, a universe of universes, exist or not? You know, so there we are clearly at the edge of what empirical investigation can tell us. And all what I'm saying is you have to remain humble in before that. What Deepak Chopra and folks like, and the New Age folks do, is they take the questions that science may ask, like the interpretations of quantum mechanics, and it chooses one of the and it chooses answers to those that don't yet exist and says, ah, science tells us that, you know, all consciousness is connected. And it's like, no, that's not, science never said that. So, you know, what's important here is to both understand the power of science and understand where and not push harder on what it can say than is reasonable. So it really, the trick here is to remain grounded while keeping your eyes looking towards the horizon.
Yes, it's a very difficult one. I mean, you've just introduced a lot of mind-boggling thoughts there, the multiverse. One of the suggestions made by some of the theoreticians about those those neutrinos that need a speeding ticket was they were going through one of the 11 dimensions called for in brain theory and theory.
Right, exactly. You know, and there's an example of where science is pushing into really, you know, either interesting or crazy ideas, right? Now, what is going on with string theory, we are really going to see, string theory is, this is its time of testing, because string theory has been around for like at least 30 years. And with the Large Hadron Collider, you know, the large experiment in CERN, it's really going to get a chance to at least show some indication of whether aspects of it are true or not. And, you know, the idea of the extra dimensions on one level is crazy, that there's all these extra dimensions that we can't see. The same thing with the multiverse. There's all these extra universes that we can't see, but somehow, you know, they are needed in order to explain the universe we can't see. All of those ideas have a very science fiction-y kind of quality to them, even though they're based in very rigorous math.
But yeah, I mean, you made the point yourself. In little more than a century, we've come from the idea that the universe was filled with some material force called the ether,
right,
which we still use as a metaphor in radio, of course, through which waves were propagated, and then we moved to an absolute vacuum, and now we're on the scientific end. I was quite content with the idea that it's not really a vacuum at all, but there are lots of particles spontaneously bouncing in and out of existence all of the time. And that's within less than a century. We've had these radical switches of perspective.
You know, the ether is a great example, because the ether, people were convinced that the ether existed, right? There were entire textbooks written on the ether. And then along comes Einstein, and he says, I don't really need the ether. And overnight, all those textbooks went away. And I wonder if string theory and some of the ideas being pursued in theoretical physics aren't much the same. As of right now, there is absolutely no evidence to support string theory. And in the next few years, either we will get some indication of string theory having some relevance to the world via the Large Hadron Collider, or if it doesn't appear, I think string theory will very much go the way of ether. People just won't pursue it anymore because it has no connection with experimental data. And that's really what separates the science from the metaphysics. And you have to be careful where you want to draw that line. It's because science fundamentally has to have empirical grounding. And as much as string theory sounds really, you know, wild and crazy, if we do not find some empirical grounding for it within the next 10 or 5 years even, I think people are going to drift away from it. There's just not going to be, you know, as exciting as an idea as it sounds, it's going to end up being philosophy. So we're at a very interesting moment. That's really the point of the book. We're at a very interesting moment in the history of cosmology, because we are at the lip. We are at the edge of the Big Bang. We're ready to replace the Big Bang. We have reasons to believe we can replace the Big Bang. But right now we have no idea of which direction we should be. We have ideas, but we have no evidence yet that points us in any new direction.
Well, this is all we have time for, Adam. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to Adam Frank on the edge of the known universe for many of us up in Rochester, New York. And your book is, of course, About Time, and thank you very much, Adam. I wish we had more time, but that's what your
book is. Listen next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.